Such as? There was a cautious note in the Commodore's voice. Such as their concern for the best interests of their people. You, on the other hand, would understand. The Commodore kept his eyes on the gravel path as they walked leisurely. His hands caressed each other behind his back. Mallow went on smoothly. Up to now, trade between our two nations has suffered because of the restrictions placed upon our traders by your government. Surely it has long been evident to you that unlimited trade... Free trade, mumbled the Commodore. Free trade, then? You must see that it would be of benefit to both of us. There are things you have that we want, and things we have that you want. It asks only an exchange to bring increased prosperity. An enlightened ruler such as yourself, a friend of the people, I might say a member of the people, needs no elaboration on that theme. I won't insult your intelligence by offering any. True, I have seen this, but what would you? His voice was a plaintive whine. Your people have always been so unreasonable. I am in favor of all the trade our economy can support, but not on your terms. I am not sole master here. His voice rose. I am only the servant of public opinion. My people will not take commerce which sparked in crimson and gold. Mallow drew himself up. A compulsory religion? So it has always been, in effect. Surely you remember the case of Asconi 20 years ago? First they were sold some of your goods, and then your people asked for complete freedom of missionary effort in order that the goods might be run properly, the temples of health be set up. There was then the establishment of religious schools, autonomous rights for all officers of the religion. And with what result? Asconi is now an integral member of the Foundation system, and the Grand Master cannot call his underwear his own. Oh, no, oh, no, the dignity of an independent people could never suffer it. None of what you speak is at all what I suggest, interposed Mal. No? No. I'm a master trader. Money is my religion. All this mysticism and hocus-pocus of the missionaries annoy me, and I'm glad you refuse to countenance it. It makes you more my type of man. The Commodore's laugh was high-pitched and jerky. Well said! The Foundation should have sent a man of your caliber before this. He laid a friendly hand upon the trader's bulking shoulder. But, man, you have told me only half. You have told me what the catch is not. Now tell me what it is. The only catch, Commodore, is that you're going to be burdened with an immense quantity of riches. Indeed? He snuffled. But what could I want with riches? The true wealth is the love of one's people. I have that. You can have both, for it is possible to gather gold with one hand and love with the other. Now that, my young man, would be an interesting phenomenon if it were possible. How would you go about it? Oh, in a number of ways. The difficulty is choosing among them. Let's see. Well, luxury items, for instance. This object here now. Mallow drew gently out of an inner pocket a flat, linked chain of polished metal. This, for instance. What is it? That's got to be demonstrated. Can you get a girl? Any young female will do. And a mirror, full length. Let's get indoors, then. The Commodore referred to his dwelling place as a house. The populace undoubtedly would call it a palace. To Mallow's straightforward eyes, it looked uncommonly like a fortress. It was built on an eminence that overlooked the capital. Its walls were thick and reinforced, its approaches were guarded, and its architecture was shaped for defense. Just the type of dwelling, Mallow thought sourly, for Asper the well-beloved. A young girl was before them. She bent low to the Commodore, who said, "This is one of the Commodore's girls. Will she do?" "Perfectly." The Commodore watched carefully while Mallow snapped the chain about the girl's waist and stepped back. The Commodore snuffled. Well, is that all? Will you draw the curtain, Commodore? Young lady, there's a little knob just near the snap. Will you move it upward, please? Go ahead. It won't hurt you. The girl did so, drew a sharp breath, looked at her hands and gasped, Oh! From her waist, as a source, she was drowned in a pale, streaming luminescence of shifting color that drew itself over her head in a flashing coronet of liquid fire. It was as if someone had torn the aurora borealis out of the sky and molded it into a cloak. The girl stepped to the mirror and stared, fascinated. Here, take this. Mallow handed her a necklace of dull pebbles. Put it around your neck. The girl did so. And each pebble, as it entered the luminescent field, became an individual flame that leaped and sparkled in crimson and gold. What do you think of it? Mallow asked her. The girl didn't answer, but there was adoration in her eyes. The Commodore gestured, and reluctantly she pushed the knob down, and the glory died. She left with a memory. "It's yours, Commodore," said Mallow, "for the Commodora. Consider it a small gift from the Foundation." "Mmm." The Commodore turned the belt and necklace over in his hand as though calculating the weight. "How is it done?" Mallow shrugged. "That's a question for our technical experts, but it will work for you without, mark you, without priestly help."
"Well, it's only feminine frippery, after all. What could you do with it? Where would the money come in?"
"You have balls, receptions, banquets, that sort of thing."
"Oh, yes.
Do you realize what women will pay for that sort of jewelry? 10,000 credits, at least." The Commodore seemed struck in a heap.
"Ah.
And since the power unit of this particular item will not last longer than 6 months, there will be the necessity of frequent replacements. Now, we can sell as many of these as you want for the equivalent in wrought iron of 1,000 credits. There's 900% profit for you." The Commodore plucked at his beard and seemed engaged in awesome mental calculations.
"Galaxy, how the dowagers will fight for them. I'll keep the supply small and let them bid. Of course, it wouldn't do to let them know that I personally..."
Mallow said, "We can explain the workings of dummy corporations if you would like. Then, working further at random, take our complete line of household gadgets. We have collapsible stoves that will roast the toughest meats to the desired tenderness in 2 minutes. We've got knives that won't require sharpening. We've got the equivalent of a complete laundry that can be packed in a small closet and will work entirely automatically. Ditto dishwashers, ditto floor scrubbers, furniture polishers, desk precipitators, lighting fixtures, oh, anything you like. Think of your increased popularity if you make them available to the public. Think of your increased quantity of worldly goods if they're available as a government monopoly at 900% profit. It will be worth many times the money to them, and they didn't know what you pay for it. And mind you, none of it will require priestly supervision. Everybody will be happy."
"Except you, it seems. What do you get out of it?"
"Just what every trader gets by Foundation law. My men and I will collect half of whatever profits we take in. Just you buy all I want to sell you, and we'll both make out quite well. Quite well." The Commodore was enjoying his thoughts.
"What did you say you wanted to be paid with? Iron?"
"That, and coal, and bauxite. Also tobacco, pepper, magnesium, hardwood. Nothing you haven't got enough of."
"It sounds well."
"I think so. Oh, and still another item at random, Commodore. I could retool your factories."
"Eh? How's that?"
"Well, take your steel foundries. I have handy little gadgets that could do tricks with steel that would cut production costs to 1% of previous marks. You could cut prices by half and still split extremely fat profits with the manufacturers. I tell you, I could show you exactly what I mean if you allowed me a demonstration. Do you have a steel foundry in the city? It wouldn't take long."
"It could be arranged, Trader Mallow, but tomorrow... Would you dine with us tonight?"
"My men," began Mallow.
"Let them all come," said the Commodore expansively. "A symbolic friendly union of our nations. It will give us a chance for further friendly discussion. But one thing..."
His face lengthened and grew stern.
"None of your religion. Don't think that all this is an entering wedge for the missionaries."
"Commodore," said Mallow dryly, "I give you my word that religion would cut my profits."
"Then that will do for now. You'll be escorted back to your ship."
6. The Commodora was much younger than her husband. Her face was pale and coldly formed, and her black hair was drawn smoothly and tightly back. Her voice was tart.
"You are quite finished, my gracious and noble husband? Quite finished? I suppose I may even enter the garden if I wish now?"
"There is no need for dramatics, Leisha, my dear," said the Commodore mildly. "The young man will attend at dinner tonight, and you can speak with him all you wish and even amuse yourself by listening to all I say. Room will have to be arranged for his men somewhere about the place. The stars grant that they be few in numbers."
"Most likely they'll be great hogs of eaters who will eat meat by the quarter animal and wine by the hogshead, and you will groan for 2 nights when you calculate the expense."
"Well, now, perhaps I won't. Despite your opinion, the dinner is to be on the most lavish scale."
"Oh, I see."
She stared at him contemptuously.
"You are very friendly with these barbarians. Perhaps that is why I was not to be permitted to attend your conversation. Perhaps your little weazened soul is plotting to turn against my father."
"Not at all."
"Yes, I'd be likely to believe you, wouldn't I? If ever a poor woman was sacrificed for policy to an unsavory marriage, it was myself. I could have picked a more proper man from the alleys and mud heaps of my native world.
Well, now, I'll tell you what, my lady. Perhaps you would enjoy returning to your native world, only to retain as a souvenir that portion of you with which I am best acquainted. I could have your tongue cut out first. And, he lolled his head calculatingly to one side, as a final improving touch to your beauty, your ears and the tip of your nose as well.
You wouldn't dare, you little pug dog. My father would pulverize your toy nation to meteoric dust. In fact, he might do it in any case if I told him you were treating with these barbarians.
Well, there's no need for threats. You are free to question the man yourself tonight. Meanwhile, madam, keep your wagging tongue still.
At your orders?
Here, take this, then, and keep still. The band was about her waist and the necklace around her neck. He pushed the knob himself and stepped back. The Condora drew in her breath and held out her hand stiffly. She fingered the necklace gingerly and gasped again. The Condor rubbed his hands with satisfaction and said, "You may wear it tonight, and I'll get you more. Now, keep still." The Condora kept still. 7. Heim Twer fidgeted and shuffled his feet. He said, "What's twisting your face?" Obermallow lifted out of his brooding. "Is my face twisted? It's not meant so."
"Something must have happened yesterday. I mean, besides that feast."
With sudden conviction, "Mallow, there's trouble, isn't there?"
"Trouble? No, quite the opposite. In fact, I'm in the position of throwing my full weight against a door and finding it ajar at the time. We're getting into the steel foundry too easily."
"You suspect a trap?"
"Oh, for Selden's sake, don't be melodramatic." Mallow swallowed his impatience and added conversationally, "It's just that the easy entrance means there will be nothing to see."
"Atomic power, huh?" Twer ruminated.
"I'll tell you, there's just about no evidence of any atomic power economy here in Corel, and it would be pretty hard to mask all signs of the widespread effects a fundamental technology such as atomics would have on everything."
"Not if it was just starting up, Twer, and being applied to a war economy. You'd find it in the shipyards and the steel foundries only."
"So if we don't find it, then..."
"Then they haven't got it, or they're not showing it.
Toss a coin or take a guess."
Twer shook his head.
"I wish I'd been with you yesterday."
"I wish you had, too," said Mallow stonily. "I have no objection to moral support. Unfortunately, it was the Condor who set the terms of the meeting and not myself. And that, outside there, would seem to be the royal ground car to escort us to the foundry. Have you got the gadgets?"
"All of them."
8. The foundry was large and bore the odor of decay which no amount of superficial repairs could quite erase. It was empty now, and in quite an unnatural state of quiet, as it played unaccustomed host to the Commodore and his court. Mallow had swung the steel sheet onto the two supports with a careless heave. He had taken the instrument held out to him by Twer and was gripping the leather handle inside its leaden sheath. "The instrument," he said, "is dangerous, but so is a buzzsaw. You just have to keep your fingers away." And as he spoke, he drew the muzzle slit swiftly down the length of the steel sheet, which quietly and instantly fell in two. There was a unanimous jump, and Mallow laughed. He picked up one of the halves and propped it against his knee. "You can adjust the cutting length accurately to 1/100 of an inch, and a 2-inch sheet will slit down the middle as easily as this thing did. If you've got the thickness exactly judged, you can place steel on a wooden table and split the metal without scratching the wood." And at each phrase, the atomic shear and a gouged chunk of steel flew across the room. "That," he said, "is whittling with steel." He passed back the shear. "Or else you have the plane. Do you want to decrease the thickness of a sheet, smooth out an irregularity, remove corrosion? Watch." Thin, transparent foil flew off the other half of the original sheet in 6-inch swarths, then 8-inch, then 12. "Or drills? It's all the same principle." They were all crowded around now. It might have been a sleight-of-hand show, a corner magician, a vaudeville act made into high-pressure salesmanship. Commodore Asper fingered scraps of steel. High officials of the government tiptoed over each other's shoulders and whispered, while Mallow punched clean, beautiful round holes through an inch of hard steel at every touch of his atomic drill. "Just one more demonstration. Bring 2 short lengths of pipe, somebody." An honorable chamberlain of something or other sprang to obedience in the general excitement and thought absorption and stained his hands like any laborer. Mallow stood them upright and shaved the ends off with a single stroke of the shear and then joined the pipes, fresh cut to fresh cut. And there was a single pipe. The new ends, with even atomic irregularities missing, formed one piece upon joining. Johannesson blocks at a stroke. Then Mallow looked up at his audience, stumbled at his first word, and stopped. There was the keen stirring of excitement in his chest, and the base of his stomach went tingly and cold. The Commodore's own bodyguard, in the confusion, had struggled to the front line, and Mallow, for the first time, was near enough to see their unfamiliar hand weapons in detail. They were atomic. There was no mistaking it. An explosive projectile weapon with a barrel like that was impossible. But that wasn't the big point. That wasn't the point at all. The butts of those weapons had, deeply etched upon them in worn gold plating, the spaceship and sun. The same spaceship and sun that was stamped on every one of the great volumes of the original encyclopedia that the Foundation had begun and not yet finished. The same spaceship and sun that had blazoned the banner of the Galactic Empire through millennia. Mallow talked through and around his thoughts. Test the pipe. It's one piece. Not perfect, naturally. The joining shouldn't be done by hand. There was no need of further legerdemain. It had gone over. Mallow was through. He had what he wanted. There was only one thing in his mind. The golden globe with its conventionalized rays and the oblique cigar shape that was a space vessel. The spaceship and sun of the Empire. The Empire. The words drilled. A century and a half had passed, but there was still the Empire somewhere deeper in the galaxy. And it was emerging again, out into the periphery. Mallow smiled. 9. The Far Star was 2 days out in space when Hober Mallow in his private quarters with Senior Lieutenant Drott handed him an envelope, a roll of microfilm, and a silvery spheroid. As of an hour from now, Lieutenant, you're acting captain of the Far Star until I return, or forever. Drott made a motion of standing, but Mallow waved him down imperiously. Quiet, and listen. The envelope contains the exact location of the planet to which you're to proceed. There, you will wait for me for 2 months. If before the 2 months are up, the Foundation locates you, the microfilm is my report of the trip. If, however, and his voice was somber, I do not return at the end of 2 months, and Foundation vessels do not locate you, proceed to the planet Terminus and hand in the time capsule as the report. Do you understand that? Yes, sir. At no time are you or any of the men to amplify in any single instance my official report. If we are questioned, sir... Then you know nothing. Yes, sir. The interview ended, and 50 minutes later, a lifeboat kicked lightly off the side of the Far Star. 10. Onum Bar was an old man, too old to be afraid. Since the last disturbances, he had lived alone on the fringes of the land with what books he had saved from the ruins. He had nothing he feared losing, least of all the worn remnant of his life, and so he faced the intruder without cringing. Your door was open, the stranger explained. His accent was clipped and harsh, and Barr did not fail to notice the strange blue steel hand weapon at his hip. In the half-gloom of the small room, Barr saw the glow of a force shield surrounding the man. He said wearily, There is no reason to keep it closed. Do you wish anything of me? Yes. The stranger remained standing in the center of the room. He was large, both in height and bulk. Yours is the only house about here.
It is a desolate place, agreed Barr. There is a town to the east. I can show you the way.
In a while. May I sit?
If the chairs will hold you, said the old man gravely. They were old, too, relics of a better youth.
The stranger said, My name is Hober Mallow. I come from a far province. Barr nodded and smiled.
Your tongue convicted you of that long ago. I am Onum Barr of Siwenna, and once patrician of the Empire.
Then this is Siwenna. I had only old maps to guide me.
They would have to be old indeed for star positions to be misplaced.
Barr sat quite still, while the other's eyes drifted away into a reverie. He noticed that the atomic force shield had vanished from about the man and admitted dryly to himself that his person no longer seemed formidable to strangers, or even for good or for evil to his enemies. He said,
My house is poor and my resources few. You may share what I have if your stomach can endure black bread and dried corn.
Mallow shook his head. No, I have eaten. And I can't stay. All I need are the directions to the center of government.
That is easily enough done, and poor though I am, deprives me of nothing. Do you mean the capital of the planet, or of the imperial sector?
The younger man's eyes narrowed. Aren't the two identical? Isn't this Siwenna? The old patrician nodded slowly.
Siwenna, yes, but Siwenna is no longer capital of the Normanic sector. Your old map has misled you after all. The stars may not change even in centuries, but political boundaries are all too fluid.
That's too bad. In fact, that's very bad. Is the new capital far off?
It's on Orsha II, 20 parsecs off. Your map will direct you. How old is it?
150 years.
That old? The old man sighed. History has been crowded since. Do you know any of it?
Mallow shook his head slowly.
Barr said, You're fortunate. It has been an evil time for the provinces, but for the reign of Stanel VI, and he died 50 years ago. Since that time, rebellion and ruin, ruin and rebellion.
Barr wondered if he were growing garrulous. It was a lonely life out here, and he had so little chance to talk to men. Mallow said with sudden sharpness, Ruin, huh? You sound as if the province were impoverished.
Perhaps not on an absolute scale. The physical resources of 25 first-rank planets take a long time to use up. Compared to the wealth of the last century, though, we have gone a long way downhill, and there is no sign of turning, not yet. Why are you so interested in all this, young man? You are all alive, and your eyes shine.
The trader came near enough to blushing, as the faded eyes seemed to look too deep into his and smile at what they saw. He said, Now look here, I'm a trader out there, out toward the rim of the galaxy. I've located some old maps, and I'm out to open new markets. Naturally, talk of impoverished provinces disturbs me. You can't get money out of a world unless money's there to be got. Now, how's Suwina, for instance?
The old man leaned forward. I cannot say. It will do even yet, perhaps. But you, a trader, you look more like a fighting man. You hold your hand near your gun, and there is a scar on your jawbone.
Mallow jerked his head. There isn't much law out there where I come from. Fighting and scars are part of a trader's overhead. But fighting is only useful when there's money at the end, and if I can get it without, so much the sweeter. Now, will I find enough money here to make it worth the fighting? I take it I can find the fighting easily enough.
Easily enough, agreed Barr. You could join Wiscard's remnants in the Red Stars. I don't know, though, if you'd call that fighting or piracy. Or in our present gracious viceroy, gracious by right of murder, pillage, rapine, and the word of a boy emperor, since rightfully assassinated.
The patrician's thin cheeks reddened. His eyes closed, and then opened bird-bright. You don't sound very friendly to the viceroy, Patrician Barr, said Mallow. What if I'm one of his spies?
What if you are? Said Barr bitterly. What can you take?
He gestured a withered arm at the bare interior of the decaying mansion. Your life?
It would leave me easily enough. It has been with me 5 years too long. But you are not one of the viceroy's men. If you were, perhaps even now, instinctive self-preservation would keep my mouth closed.
How do you know?
The old man laughed. You seem suspicious. Come, I'll wager you think I'm trying to trap you into denouncing the government. No, no, I am past politics.
Past politics? Is a man ever past that? The words you used to describe the viceroy, what were they? Murder, pillage, all that? You didn't sound objective. Not exactly. Not as if you were past politics.
The old man shrugged. Memories sting when they come suddenly. Listen, judge for yourself. When Siena was the provincial capital, I was a patrician and a member of the provincial senate. My family was an old and honored one. One of my great-grandfathers had been... Oh, no, never mind that. Past glories are poor feeding.
I take it, said Mallow, there was a civil war or a revolution. Barr's face darkened.
Civil wars are chronic in these degenerate days, but Siena had kept apart. Under Stanel VI, it had almost achieved its ancient prosperity. But weak emperors followed, and weak emperors mean strong viceroys. And our last viceroy, the same Wiscard whose remnants still prey on the commerce among the Red Stars, aimed at the imperial purple. He wasn't the first to aim, and if he had succeeded, he wouldn't have been the first to succeed. But he failed, for when the emperor's admiral approached the province at the head of a fleet, Siena itself rebelled against its rebel viceroy.
He stopped sadly. Mallow found himself tense on the edge of his seat and relaxed slowly. Please continue, sir.
Thank you, said Barr wearily. It's kind of you to humor an old man. They rebelled, or I should say we rebelled, for I was one of the minor leaders. Wiscard left Siena, barely ahead of us, and the planet, and with it the province, were thrown open to the admiral with every gesture of loyalty to the emperor. Why we did this, I'm not sure. Maybe we felt loyal to the symbol, if not to the person of the emperor. A cruel and vicious child. Maybe we feared the horrors of a siege.
Well, urged Mallow gently.
Well, came the grim retort, that didn't suit the admiral. He wanted the glory of conquering a rebellious province, and his men wanted the loot such conquest would involve. So while the people were still gathered in every large city, cheering the emperor and his admiral, he occupied all armed centers and then ordered the population put to the atom blast.
On what pretext?
On the pretext that they had rebelled against their viceroy, the emperor's anointed, and the admiral became the new viceroy by virtue of 1 month of massacre, pillage, and complete horror. I had 6 sons. 5 died variously. I had a daughter. I hope she died eventually. I escaped because I was old. I came here too old to cause even our viceroy worry. He bent his gray head. They left me nothing because I had helped drive out a rebellious governor and deprived an admiral of his glory.
Mallow sat silent and waited. Then, what of your 6th son? He asked softly.
Eh? Thayer smiled acidly. He is safe, for he has joined the admiral as a common soldier under an assumed name. He is a gunner in the viceroy's personal fleet. Oh, no, I see your eyes. He is not an unnatural son. He visits me when he can and gives me what he can. He keeps me alive. And some day, our great and glorious viceroy will grovel to his death, and it will be my son who will be his executioner.
And you tell this to a stranger? You endanger your son?
Now I help him by introducing a new enemy. And were I a friend of the viceroy, as I am his enemy, I would tell him to string outer space with ships clear to the rim of the galaxy.
There are no ships there?
Did you find any? Did any space guards question your entry? With ships few enough and the bordering provinces filled with their share of intrigue and iniquity, none can be spared to guard the barbarian outer suns. No danger ever threatened us from the broken edge of the galaxy until you came.
I'm no danger.
There will be more after you.
Mallow shook his head slowly. I'm not sure I understand you.
Listen. There was a feverish edge to the old man's voice. I knew you when you entered. You have a force shield about your body, or had when I first saw you.
Doubtful silence. Then, yes, I had.
Good. That was a flaw, but you didn't know that. There are some things I know. It's out of fashion in these decaying times to be a scholar. Events race and flash past, and who cannot fight the tide with atom blast in hand is swept away as I was. But I was a scholar, and I know that in all the history of atomics, no portable force shield was ever invented. We have force shields, huge lumbering powerhouses that will protect a city or even a ship, but not one single man.
Ah? Mallow's underlip thrust out. And what do you deduce from that?
There have been stories percolating through space. They travel strange paths and become distorted with every parsec. But when I was young, there was a small ship of strange men who did not know our customs and could not tell where they came from. They talked of magicians at the edge of the galaxy, magicians who glowed in the darkness, who flew unaided through the air, and whom weapons would not touch. We laughed. I laughed, too. I forgot it till today. But you glow in the darkness, and I don't think my blaster, if I had one, would hurt you. Tell me, can you fly through air as you sit there now?
Mallow said calmly. I can make nothing of all this.
Barr smiled. I am content with the answer. I do not examine my guests. But if there are magicians, if you are one of them, there may some day be a great influx of them, or you. Perhaps that would be well. Maybe we need new blood.
He muttered soundlessly to himself, then slowly,
But it works the other way, too. Our new viceroy also dreams, as did our old Wiscard.
Also after the Emperor's crown?
Barr nodded. My son hears tales. In the viceroy's personal entourage, one could scarcely help it. And he tells me of them. Our new viceroy would not refuse the crown if offered, but he guards his line of retreat. There are stories that, failing imperial heights, he plans to carve out a new empire in the barbarian hinterland. It is said, but I don't vouch for this, that he has already given one of his daughters as wife to a kinglet somewhere in the uncharted periphery.
If one listened to every story,
I know. There are many more. I'm old and I babble nonsense. But what do you say?
And those sharp old eyes peered deep. The trader considered. I say nothing, but I'd like to ask something. Does Siwena have atomic power? No, wait, I know that it possesses the knowledge of atomics. I mean, do they have power generators intact, or did the recent sack destroy them?
Destroy them? Oh, no. Half a planet would be wiped out before the smallest power station would be touched. They are irreplaceable, and the suppliers of the strength of the fleet, almost proudly, we have the largest and best on this side of Trantor itself.
Then what would I do first if I wanted to see these generators?
Nothing. Replied Barr decisively. You couldn't approach any military center without being shot down instantly. Neither could anyone. Siwena is still deprived of civic rights.
You mean all the power stations are under the military?
No, there are the small city stations, the ones supplying power for heating and lighting homes, powering vehicles and so forth. Those are almost as bad. They're controlled by the tech men. Who are they? A specialized group which supervises the power plants. The honor is hereditary, the young ones being brought up in the profession as apprentices. Strict sense of duty, honor, and all that. No one but a tech man could enter a station.
I see.
I don't say, though, added Barr, that there aren't cases where tech men haven't been bribed. In days when we have 9 emperors in 50 years and 7 of these are assassinated, when every space captain aspires to the usurpation of a viceroyship and every viceroy to the Imperium, I suppose even a tech man can fall prey to money. But it would require a good deal, and I have none. Have you?
Money?
No. But does one always bribe with money? What else, when money buys all else? There is quite enough that money won't buy. And now, if you'll tell me the nearest city of one of the stations and how best to get there, I'll thank you.
Wait.
Barr held out his thin hands. Where do you rush? You come here, but I ask no questions. In the city, where the inhabitants are still called rebels, you would be challenged by the first soldier or guard who heard your accent and saw your clothes. He rose, and from an obscure corner of an old chest brought out a booklet. My passport, forged. I escaped with it. He placed it in Mallow's hand and folded the fingers over it. The description doesn't fit, but if you flourish it, the chances are many to one they will not look closely.
But you'll be left without one.
The old exile shrugged cynically.
What of it? And a further caution. Curb your tongue. Your accent is barbarous, your idioms peculiar, and every once in a while you deliver yourself of the most astounding archaisms. The less you speak, the less suspicion you will draw upon yourself. Now, I'll tell you how to get to the city.
5 minutes later, Mallow was gone. He returned but once for a moment to the old patrician's house before leaving it entirely, however. And when Onum Barr stepped into his little garden early the next morning, he found a box at his feet. It contained provisions, concentrated provisions such as one would find aboard ship, and alien in taste and preparation. But they were good, and last long. 11. The tech man was short, and his skin glistened with well-kept plumpness. His hair was a fringe, and his skull shone through pinkly. The rings on his fingers were thick and heavy. His clothes were scented, and he was the first man Mallow had met on the planet who hadn't looked hungry. The tech man's lips pursed peevishly.
Now, my man, quickly. I have things of great importance waiting for me. You seem a stranger.
He seemed to evaluate Mallow's definitely un-Siwanese costume, and his eyelids were heavy with suspicion.
I am not of the neighborhood, said Mallow calmly, but the matter is irrelevant. I have had the honor to send you a little gift yesterday.
The tech man's nose lifted.
I received it. An interesting gigaw. I may have use for it on occasion.
I have other and more interesting gifts, quite out of the gigaw stage.
Oh?
The tech man's voice lingered thoughtfully over the monosyllable.
I think I already see the course of the interview. It has happened before. You're going to give me some trifle or other, a few credits, perhaps a cloak, second-rate jewelry, anything your little soul may think sufficient to corrupt the tech man.
His lower lip puffed out belligerently.
And I know what you wish in exchange. There have been others to suffice with the same bright idea. You wish to be adopted into our clan. You wish to be taught the mysteries of atomics and the care of the machines. You think because you dogs of Siwena, and probably your strangerhood is assumed for safety's sake, are being daily punished for your rebellion, that you can escape what you deserve by throwing over yourselves the privileges and protections of the Tech Man's Guild.
Mallow would have spoken, but the tech man raised himself into a sudden roar.
And now leave, before I report your name to the protector of the city. Do you think that I would betray the trust? The Siwanese traitors that preceded me, perhaps, but you deal with a different breed now. By galaxy, I marvel that I do not kill you myself at this moment with my bare hands.
Mallow smiled to himself. The entire speech was patently artificial in tone and content, so that all the dignified indignation degenerated into uninspired farce. The traitor glanced humorously at the 2 flabby hands that had been named as his possible executioners then and there, and said,
Your wisdom, you are wrong on 3 counts.
First, I am not a creature of the viceroy come to test your loyalty. Second, my gift is something the emperor himself in all his splendor does not and will never possess. Third, what I wish in return is very little, a nothing, a mere breath.
So you say,
he descended into heavy sarcasm.
Come, what is this imperial donation that your godlike power wishes to bestow upon me? Something the Emperor doesn't have, eh? He broke into a sharp squawk of derision. Mallow rose and pushed the chair aside. I have waited 3 days to see you, Your Wisdom, but the display will take only 3 seconds. If you will just draw that blaster whose butt I see very near your hand,
eh?
And shoot me, I will be obliged.
What?
If I'm killed, you can tell the police I tried to bribe you into betraying guild secrets. You'll receive high praise. If I'm not killed, you may have my shield. For the first time, the tech man became aware of the dimly white illumination that hovered closely about his visitor, as though he had been dipped in pearl dust. His blaster raised to the level, and with eyes asquint in wonder and suspicion, he closed contact. The molecules of air caught in the sudden surge of atomic disruption tore into glowing, burning ions and marked out the blinding thin line that struck at Mallow's heart and splashed. While Mallow's look of patience never changed, the atomic forces that tore at him consumed themselves against that fragile, pearly illumination and crashed back to die in midair. The tech man's blaster dropped to the floor with an unnoticed crash. Mallow said, "Does the Emperor have a personal force shield? You can have one." The tech man stuttered,
Are you a tech man?
No.
Then where did you get that?
What do you care? Mallow was coolly contemptuous. Do you want it? A thin, knobbed chain fell upon the desk. There it is. The tech man snatched it up and fingered it nervously.
Is this complete?
Complete.
Where's the power?
Mallow's finger fell upon the largest knob, dull in its leaden case. The tech man looked up, and his face was congested with blood.
Sir, I am a tech man, senior grade. I have 20 years behind me as a supervisor, and I studied under the great Blair at the University of Trantor. If you have the infernal charlatanry to tell me that a small container the size of a walnut blasted holes an atomic generator, I'll have you before the protector in 3 seconds.
Explain it yourself, then, if you can. I say it's complete. The tech man's flush faded slowly as he bound the chain about his waist, and following Mallow's gesture, pushed the knob. The radiance that surrounded him shone into dim relief. His blaster lifted, then hesitated. Slowly he adjusted it to an almost burnless minimum. And then, convulsively, he closed circuit, and the atomic fire dashed against his hand harmlessly. He whirled.
And what if I shoot you now and keep the shield?
Try, said Mallow. Do you think I gave you my only sample? And he, too, was solidly encased in light. The tech man giggled nervously. The blaster clattered onto the desk. He said,
And what is this mere nothing, this breath that you wish in return?
I want to see your generators.
You realize that that is forbidden. It would mean ejection into space for both of us.
I don't want to touch them or have anything to do with them. I want to see them from a distance.
If not,
you have your shield, but I have other things. For one thing, a blaster especially designed to pierce that shield. The tech man's eyes shifted.
Come with me.
12. The tech man's home was a small two-story affair on the outskirts of the huge, cubiform, windowless affair that dominated the center of the city. Mallow passed from one to the other through an underground passage and found himself in the silent, ozone-tinged atmosphere of the powerhouse. For 15 minutes, he followed his guide and said nothing. His eyes missed nothing. His fingers touched nothing. And then the tech man said in strangled tones,
Have you had enough? I couldn't trust my underlings in this case.
Could you ever? Asked Mallow ironically. I've had enough. They were back in the office, and Mallow said thoughtfully, And all those generators are in your hands?
Every one,
said the tech man, with more than a touch of complacency. And you keep them running and in order?
Right.
And if they break down? The tech man shook his head indignantly.
They don't break down. They never break down. They were built for eternity.
Eternity is a long time. Just suppose
it is unscientific to suppose meaningless cases.
All right. Suppose I were to blast a vital part into nothingness. I suppose the machines aren't immune to atomic forces. Suppose I fuse a vital connection or smash a quartz D-tube.
Well, then, shouted the tech man furiously, you would be killed.
Yes, I know that. Mallow was shouting, too. But what about the generator? Could you repair it?
Sir...
The tech man howled his words.
You have had a fair return. You've had what you asked for. Now get out. I owe you nothing more.
Mallow bowed with a satiric respect and left. 2 days later, he was back at the base where the Far Star waited to return with him to the planet Terminus.
and 2 days later, the tech man's shield went dead, and for all his puzzling and cursing, never glowed again. 13. Mallow relaxed for almost the first time in 6 months. He was on his back in the sunroom of his new house, stripped to the skin. His great brown arms were thrown up and out, and the muscles tautened into a stretch, then faded into repose. The man beside him placed a cigar between Mallow's teeth and lit it. He champed on one of his own and said, "You must be overworked. Maybe you need a long rest." "Maybe I do, Jail. But I'd rather rest in a council seat, because I'm going to have that seat, and you're going to help me." Anchor Jail raised his eyebrows and said, "How did I get into this?" "You got in, obviously. Firstly, you're an old dog of a politico. Secondly, you were booted out of your cabinet seat by Geraint Sutt, the same fellow who'd rather lose an eyeball than see me in the council. You don't think much of my chances, do you?" "Not much," agreed the ex-minister of education. "You're a Smyrnian." "That's no legal bar. I've had a lay education." "Well, come now. Since when does prejudice follow any law but its own? Now, how about your own man, this Chaim Twer? What does he say?"
"He spoke about running me for council almost a year ago," replied Mallow easily, "but I've outgrown him. He couldn't have pulled it off in any case. Not enough depth. He's loud and forceful, but that's only an expression of nuisance value. I'm off to put over a real coup. I need you."
"Geraint Sutt is the cleverest politician on the planet, and he'll be against you. I don't claim to be able to outsmart him, and don't think he doesn't fight hard and dirty."
"I've got money."
"That helps, but it takes a lot to buy off prejudice, you dirty Smyrnian."
"I'll have a lot."
"Well, I'll look into the matter. But don't ever you crawl up on your hind legs and bleat that I encouraged you in the matter."
"Who's that?"
Mallow pulled the corners of his mouth down and said, "Geraint Sutt himself, I think. He's early, and I can understand it. I've been dodging him for a month. Look, Jail, get into the next room and turn the speaker on low. I want you to listen." He helped the council member out of the room with a shove of his bare foot, then scrambled up and into a silk robe. The synthetic sunlight faded to normal power. The secretary to the mayor entered stiffly, while the solemn major domo tiptoed the door shut behind him. Mallow fastened his belt and said, "Take a choice of chairs, Sutt." Sutt barely cracked a flicking smile. The chair he chose was comfortable, but he did not relax into it. From its edge, he said, "If you'll state your terms to begin with, we'll get down to business."
"What terms?"
"You wish to be coaxed? Well then, what, for instance, did you do at Corel? Your report was incomplete."
"I gave it to you months ago. You were satisfied then."
"Yes." Sutt rubbed his forehead thoughtfully with one finger. "But since then, your activities have been significant. We know a good deal of what you're doing, Mallow. We know exactly how many factories you're putting up, in what a hurry you're doing it, and how much it's costing you. And there's this palace you have." He gazed about him with a cold lack of appreciation, "which sets you back considerably more than my annual salary. And a swath you've been cutting, a very considerable and expensive swath, through the upper layers of Foundation society."
"So, beyond proving that you employ capable spies, what does it show?"
"It shows you have money you didn't have a year ago, and that can show anything. For instance, that a good deal went on at Corel that we know nothing of. Where are you getting your money?"
This book is continued at this point, on the other side of this cassette.